Well, what's up, everyone? Happy New Year. Welcome to 2022, and welcome to church. You know, every January, we get this fresh start. We get a new page, a clean sheet of music. In golf, it's called a mulligan. We get a new beginning. And it's actually impossible to predict what 2022 holds for any of us. The truth is, we don't know what's coming our way this year. It could be great victories. It could be incredible adversity. We just don't know. We can't control most of what's going to happen to us, but we can control how we prepare our hearts and our souls and our minds for whatever may come. So I hope that one of your resolutions this year is to be in worship every week. And here you are. You have your first major victory of the new year. You know, I heard about one poor guy who decided to make only resolutions this year that he could keep. And so he resolved to gain weight. He resolved to stop exercising and to read less and to watch more TV and to procrastinate more and to quit giving money and time to charity, to not date a single Kardashian. Like, fully obtainable resolutions. And it's all a little silly, really, because what we need, of course, is not another resolution. We need a revolution. We need a turning point in our lives. We need to experience true transformation of the mind and heart. And I believe that that's possible for us in 2022. We'll talk about more about that in just a minute. But I want to extend a very special welcome to those of you who are coming back to Grace after visiting our Christmas Eve services, a very family Christmas. What an incredible blessing it was to spend time together with you. And I'm convinced that even though, yes, you decided to come back and be with us again today, that God was also involved in you being here. Like, there's a reason that you came back, and I pray that you would be open to what God has for you today. And listen, I know I teased earlier about resolutions, but I want to encourage you, if you're new today, and this is your first shot at church in a while, or maybe forever, what would you commit to attending for the next 3 weeks? Today, we're starting a series called Lies I Believe, where we're going to sift through some of the most common lies and, you know, the things that exist about God and faith and the Christian life, and we're going to replace those lies with God's truth. And I think it's going to be a very meaningful series for you, no matter where you're at on your faith journey. And so, would you make a commitment today to give church a try consecutively for the next 3 Sundays? I just think you're going to be grateful for the jump start that it'll give to your spiritual life and a great habit builder for the new year. I think prioritizing your relationship with God is the very best thing that you can do in 2022. Now, there are a couple of resources that I want to shout out as we begin that have provided some source material for this series. One of them is a book called Lies We Believe by Dr. Chris Thurman. And the other is called Live No Lies by John Mark Comer. So let's talk about lies for a moment. You know, growing up, most of us were told that lying to others was a bad thing to do. I made a big deal anytime my kids would lie to me when they were little. I remember freaking out my oldest son, Caleb, the first time that he lied to me when he was about 3. I swear it shocked him so much that it was a good 5 years before he tried lying again. But lying is a big mistake. Lying is like a gateway drug for kids that leads to all kinds of other bad stuff. But while lying to others is undeniably wrong, not many of us were raised to understand that one of the biggest mistakes we can make is to lie to ourselves. Listen to how Thurman says it. He says, we lie to ourselves every day, multiple times a day. We tell ourselves things that are inaccurate, distorted, untrue, irrational, mistaken, and most important, unbiblical. The lies we tell ourselves cost us dearly. They cost us good relationships with others, a sense of meaning and purpose, emotional health, well-lived lives, confidence that we have worth and an intimate relationship with the God of the universe who created us in his image. These lies can lead us down a very dark path. Here's Thurman again. He says, when we tell ourselves the truth and allow God to help us internalize it in the deepest part of our being, we nourish our souls. And we can more fully experience the abundant life. And the amazing thing is, we have a choice in the matter. Each day we decide whether to believe lies or the truth. And that one choice determines how meaningful our time on earth turns out to be. It determines our ability to offer and receive love and the overall quality of our spiritual, psychological, and even physical health. In other words, the choice we make about the thoughts we carry into each day determines everything of true importance in life. So the lies that we believe come from a variety of sources. Some of those lies came from our parents, as good a job as they may have tried to do. We were all raised by imperfect parents. I remember asking my mom when I was 8 years old why, when she threw chewed gum out the car window, that it wasn't littering. And until I was about 42, I still believed that it helped improve the traction on other cars' tires. She lied straight to my face. I forgive you, Mom. Lies come from our world, too. They come from our culture and advertisers and news anchors. And lies come from the church. Every pastor has a fallen view of reality. Lies come from our own broken minds. And finally, lies come from the devil himself. Jesus called Satan the father of lies. In fact, our fight with the devil is first and foremost a fight to take back control of our minds from their captivity to lies and to liberate them with the weapon of truth. Jesus himself promised this. He said, "You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." Free from what? Free from the prison of lies. Now, your ability to believe the truth instead of believing lies will have a dramatic impact on the outcome of your life. I've seen so many examples of this, the devastating effects that self-deception can have on a person. On the other hand, I've also seen the freedom that comes from building your life on the truth, even if that truth is hard. Now listen, Christians aren't immune to believing lies. In fact, there are many falsehoods and half-truths that have crept into Christianity. And so this month, we're going to call them out. We're going to shine a light on them and fight back with the truth. In fact, we've created a resource based on an idea from Comer's book. It's called A Combating Lies Handbook. You can access that from our daily resource page over at whoisgrace.com/read. And today, I want to zero in on maybe the most popular lie about God in our Western version of Christianity. And the lie is this: God just wants me to be happy. That lie, above all else, says that God is after your happiness, and he never wants anything bad to happen to you. The tragedy of this lie is that so many people end up walking away from God and walking away from the Christian faith because of this false belief. They say things like, "Well, I tried God, and I tried Christianity, I tried church, and it just didn't what? Work for me." And the reasons that they point to as evidence that it didn't work are things like, "Oh, I'm not any better off financially, and my marriage is still hard, and my kids are still wayward, and my cancer came back," whatever it is. And underneath it is the idea that God's main job is to make me happy, and he didn't. And if you believe that God should make you happy all the time, and you end up not being happy, then God must have failed. But God didn't fail. You just believed a lie. In fact, God has a history of letting very difficult things happen to his people. Imagine if Job judged his status with God based on how well his circumstances were going, or how happy he was in the moment. Or imagine if the Apostle Paul had said, "You know what, I'm trying to start all these churches and I keep running into roadblocks. And people are beating me up and stoning me and running me out of town after town. I'm not super happy right now, so this must not be what God wants for me." Can you imagine? Like, there are a couple of lies at play here when you say, "God just wants me to be happy." Here's the lie about me. It's that my needs are the most important thing. They're not. There's also a lie about God, that God exists to serve me. He doesn't. He exists for his own glory and honor. Here's the truth. God is after things that are deeper than my happiness. Now, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but let me just share my big idea today. It's when you aim for happy, you're aiming too low. I want to spend a few minutes describing the problem and the origination of this modern lie before we dive into some clarifying truths. In the early 2000s, there was an extensive study done with American teenagers to identify their predominant beliefs and their view of the world. Sociologists Christian Smith and Melinda Lundquist Denton coined a phrase to name the dominant core belief of these teenagers. Here's the phrase. It's the term moralistic therapeutic deism. They found that the majority of teenagers basically believe that there is a God, which is a start, but that all he wants for us is for us to be happy and nice. So moralistic, which places a high value on being good, therapeutic, which is a high value in feeling good about yourself, and deism, which is the belief that God exists as the creator, but after that, he's relatively uninvolved in human affairs. And so in the 20 or so subsequent years since this study put words to this, this worldview has seeped into churches and into the hearts and minds of most Christians at some level. Like, as long as you're pursuing personal happiness and niceness, you're going to heaven. Other than that, you don't really need God or Jesus Christ at all in your life. But your happiness is the priority number one. This mindset of moralistic, therapeutic deism has naturally morphed into this sort of believe-in-yourself-ism. The message has become, you're all you need. You don't need God for anything else as long as he's helping you to be happy and nice. And it's led to what I would call the false doctrine of Christian happiness. And it goes something like this. Here are some of the key tenets of this false doctrine. One is, whatever makes me happy must be right, and whatever makes me unhappy must be wrong. Two, all discomfort, delay, risk, suffering, inconveniences, and obstacles must not be from God. Three, I will worship at the altar of comfort, money, pleasure, and things. Four, God exists to serve me. The creator and sustainer of the universe is nothing more than a cosmic vending machine. When I make a prayer deposit, he must deliver a blessing. These are all lies that many people believe, whether they would say them out loud or not. This is not the God of the Bible. Now, listen, you have to understand, God is also not some killjoy either. He's not sitting up there wringing his hands waiting to find out new ways to make your life miserable. No, we need to get to the truth on this. And the first step is to think about the nature of happiness itself. Usually when people think about happiness, they're thinking about circumstances, things like their job, their relationships, their hobbies, their health. If these things are going well, they're happy. If these things aren't going well, they're not happy. The Bible takes us to a deeper place. It takes us beyond just happiness to joy. It takes us beyond momentary pleasure to lasting abundance. Our big idea stated that when we aim for happiness, we're aiming too low. And so let's explore this idea of aiming for more than just happiness. To begin, I want you to listen to this truth in the words of Jesus in John 10:10. He's talking about Satan when he says this. He says, "The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. But I came that they may have life and have it abundantly." Here's the first thing I want you to see. God never promised happiness, but he did promise the abundant life. And listen, the abundant life is possible regardless of our circumstances. This English word happiness comes from a word for happening. Like you're happy when what you want to happen happens, and when what you want to happen doesn't happen, you're not happy. Say that 10 times. But Jesus is always very realistic. He promised that your circumstances will go bad at some point. Like the happenings of your life will get difficult. This is true for everyone, including his followers. And so he's careful to point out that there is a big difference between happiness and the joy that leads to abundance. Happiness is a feeling that can be fleeting, while joy is steady and sure. Think about some of the things that make you happy. Maybe a new gadget. You know that sense of euphoria when you buy something new and open it up. Or maybe when you get a raise. Or maybe when you lose some weight or your sports team wins a big game or you get a great response to your social media post. There's this instant happy feeling, this rush of endorphins. And that's fine, but it just doesn't last long. Newer gadgets eventually come out. A sports team loses. Most social media posts are duds. That happiness is fleeting, but joy takes us beyond just an emotion to a spiritual state of being. Happiness is an emotion tied to our circumstances. Joy is a state of mind that's tied to our identity. Joy comes from who you are and not what you have. Joy is solid and foundational. Happiness is fleeting and temperamental, which means joy can exist whether happiness is there or not. So when Jesus talked about the abundant life, he wasn't talking about being happy with your circumstances all the time. You can never build an identity on a feeling. Feelings are too fragile, that they're too flimsy to sustain the weight of an actual life. But abundance comes when the weighty things of life are in place, things like purpose, things like love and hope and wisdom and peace. See, the newest iPad isn't going to provide you with your life's purpose. A new boyfriend isn't going to provide you with the wisdom of the ages. Probably just the opposite, knowing some of the dudes out there. A new job won't give you the peace that passes understanding. But when you possess these deeper things, these fruits of the abundant life, then you have the tools, listen, to navigate bouts with unhappiness, bouts with struggle, which are universal, and to come out the other side stronger. So I'll just say from experience that it's totally different walking with somebody through a difficult season, the loss of a job, the loss of a loved one, a season of heartache and pain. It's easier to walk with them when they have a deep and abiding relationship with Christ. than when they're just chasing happiness. Like when somebody has direct access to wisdom and peace and purpose, it shows. And they carry themselves with an abiding joy. They carry themselves with an abundance, even through tears. It's a beautiful thing to watch. But the opposite is also true. You can see someone who on the outside has it all together. They have all the toys. They have all the new shiny stuff. They have all the good looks and the hot significant other, whatever. And they can still be totally empty inside because the quest for happiness in circumstances does not yield the same results as abiding joy. Here's the second thing I want you to see as we consider aiming beyond happiness. It's that God doesn't want you to be happy with the wrong things. Did you ever think about that? Like here's what the world does. The world says, if you get this, if you buy this, if you have this, if you trade this in, if you date this, if you nip this and tuck this, if you accomplish this, if you move this into your house, if you post this picture, then you're gonna be happy. And some of you have tried a bunch of that stuff, and in the end, you're like, you know what? I'm still not happy. You know why? Because God doesn't want you to be happy with only the things of this world. He doesn't want you to be happy with the cheap imitations when the real thing is available. Like I referenced this passage in our last series, but it applies here too. It's John's take and it's so pointed. I really love and appreciate it. He says over in 1 John 2, 15 to 17, he says, do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh, the desires of the eyes, the pride of life, is not from the Father, but is from the world. And the world is passing away with all its desires. But whoever does the will of God abides forever. What's he saying? He's saying God doesn't want you to find ultimate satisfaction in things that are stupid or sinful or wrong or unwise. He doesn't want you to be fully happy with the things of earth because you were made for heaven. Like, why is it that so many of us give in to sin so often? Well, we think it's going to make us happy. It looks appealing. It looks fun. But Jesus says, no, you don't have to live for the lower things of this world. Set your heart on my ways, my teachings. Like, you were made for a higher level of satisfaction, not the cheap and temporary thrills that this world can offer. You were made for more. So I shared this story from Max Lucado a while back, but it's worth repeating here. I've added my own little details, but he posed a question. He said, would a fish ever be happy on a beach? I mean, we all like going to the beach, right? Beaches are great. Why on earth wouldn't a fish be happy on the beach? Beaches are awesome. So take a fish out of the water, put the fish on the beach, tell it to be happy. What happens? Well, it starts flopping around. Doesn't seem happy. So he said, well, we need to try harder to make this fish happy. Let's give the fish some of the pleasures of this world. And so you give the fish a pile of cash. You make it, you know, rain Benjamins on that little crappie. Did you make the crappie happy? No, you didn't. And so you throw a party for the fish. Surely that will make it happy. You put on some great movies like the Codfather, maybe a little James Pond. Okay, get ready for more dad jokes. They're coming hard. How about you get some really beautiful fish and lay them there next to that fish? Put on some good club dance music and get things really hopping. Play some Swim Shady. Is the fish happy now? No, he's not. Well, okay, bust out the booze. Give him some margaritas. Maybe puff a few joints. Or maybe have the fish take some selfies. Get him a record number of likes on Fish Talk. I warned you. I mean, the likes and the comments, they start rolling in. Oh, you look so good. Fire, fire, fire. And the fish is like, no, bro, no fire. Fire and fish don't mix well. Is the fish happy? No. Like, what if you give the fish some fish porn? Like, I don't know how you get fish to be more naked than they already are, but you have some sexy bronzino who poses up, whatever. Now we're getting ridiculous. But you see my point. The answer is the fish will never be happy on the beach. Why? It's simple. The fish wasn't created for the beach. The fish will shrivel and die on the beach. And if today you find yourself wondering why you aren't happy, living for the things of this world, it's because you weren't created for this world. You were created by God, for God, to live for the things of God. You were created for a higher pleasure, a higher joy. You were created to seek first His kingdom and His righteousness, and He'll take care of all the other stuff. So God doesn't want you to be happy with the things of this world. And because God loves you, He has set limits and boundaries for you to live within. This is what a good father does so his child doesn't get hurt, and He's offering you the abundant life. So he doesn't want us to be ultimately happy with the wrong things. Here's the third thing I want you to see as we take aim for more than just happiness. It's that instead of pursuing happiness, pursue a right relationship with God. If you're aiming at happiness only, you're aiming at the wrong target. You see, in the world of moralistic therapeutic deism, the idea that is that God really isn't that involved. And so every activity is judged simply by, does it make me feel good in the moment? And is it not obviously hurting anyone else? And so you don't need to look at what God has to say about your behavior. As long as it makes you feel good and isn't causing obvious harm, then game on. And this quest for temporary happiness is leading you into sin. Like whether it's sleeping around or whether it's drinking or drugs or spending money you don't have, but you wouldn't call it sin, because if you don't immediately see any negative effects, then these behaviors are fine. And what you're doing is you're actually redefining sin into your own framework. Your new definition of sin is just anything that has immediate harmful consequences on you or others. And if it doesn't appear to, then it's full steam ahead. This is the dominant religion of our time. It's preached incessantly in movies, on TV, on YouTube, on social media, in schools, in colleges. Be happy and just don't hurt anybody. The Bible has a much more robust approach to sin. Sin, you see, isn't just what makes you not happy. Sin is rebellion against God. The word for sin in the Bible is this word hamartia. It means to miss the mark. And when we consistently choose sin over God, regardless of how it makes you feel in the moment or what it does to anyone else in the moment, it erodes your relationship with God. And not only that, sin has a cumulative effect that can't always be measured in the moment. Like when you fall into a little sin, and then it's another little sin, and sin after sin, it will gradually destroy you. It's usually not one big decision. Like you didn't wake up one morning and say, well, I'm gonna lose my family today, or I'm gonna throw away everything I love and care for today, or I'm gonna alienate my kids and ruin my marriage today, or I'm gonna go out and have an affair today, or I'm gonna gamble my future away today, I'm gonna destroy my life with that addiction today. It wasn't like that. It was more gradual. You took one small step and then another small step and then another small step, and suddenly you realize you're miles away from the person you thought you were. And you find yourself in a place you never dreamed you'd be. See, it's never a quick fall. It's usually a slow fall over time. Sin will take you further than you want to go, and it'll keep you longer than you want to stay, and it'll cost you more than you ever wanted to pay. And so when God defines sin and holiness, he's not trying to take away our happiness. He's trying to give us joy. He's trying to line us up with the way that the world was designed to work. And so when God comes in and says, here's how sex works, he's not trying to bully anyone into doing what they don't want to do. He's saying, no, I made sex. This was my idea. I know how this thing works. Do it my way and you will maximize your joy factor. When he talks about money or marriage or Sabbath or forgiveness, he's saying, here's how I designed it to work. And abundant life is found in your obedience to how I wired the universe to work rather than how you think the universe should work. So we run to God with joy because he's leading us to abundance. See, God doesn't want us to just be happy. He wants us to be holy. And it is holiness that connects us with the source of true happiness. And so the answer is to pursue God himself. When we're connected to him, even circumstances that we would have previously described as sources of unhappiness, they take on a whole new purpose when we're connected to God. Romans 5:3-5 says this. It says that even the pain points to healing. Listen, he says, we rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope, and hope does not put us to shame because God's love has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit who has been given to us. We rejoice in our suffering. This is in direct contrast to the religion of moralistic therapeutic deism. This says that pain and suffering is actually part of our healing. Now, I'm always nervous to tell you which shows I've recently watched, since you tend to judge my spiritual maturity by it. But hey, I'm an open book. So Kim and I recently watched a series called Dope Sick. about the opioid crisis of the 90s and early 2000s. And it's the story of OxyContin and how the Sackler family and Purdue Pharma had created an industry around getting rid of all pain in America. Like, if anyone had pain, it should be treated and numbed by this drug. If the pain increased, their approach was just increase the dosages of Oxy. And obviously, Big Pharma was getting richer and more corrupt, and people were getting more and more addicted, and lives were being ruined by this drug that was left to run wild. But there was an interesting part of the show where the Sackler family was trying to get this drug approved in other countries of the world to increase their reach and obviously their profit. Specifically, they focused on Germany that they believed was the key to unlocking Europe. The roadblock for OxyContin in Germany wasn't political and it wasn't even public health related. It was a philosophical difference between Germany and the United States as it relates to pain. They said the Germans had no interest in numbing all pain. Instead, they believed that suffering was actually crucial for healing. That feeling some of the pain of an injury is actually an integral part of the healing process. Yeah, I think there's truth there. And if you want to be right with God, if you want to be holy, if you want to live a deeply satisfying life, the answer is not to run around to pleasure after pleasure that brings temporary happiness, to try to numb all the pain or ignore all the pain in your life. We all have pain. We all walk through difficulties. The key is to be in relationship with the one who is growing us and developing us and who can bring true healing and happiness. And if we are, we can actually rejoice in our suffering. You see, true happiness cannot be rooted in a set of circumstances. Instead, it is the result of being rightly related to God. That's why if you have ever heard someone say, like, just become a Christian and you're going to be happy all the time because God will make your life easier, that is not true. The storms still come for everyone equally. But we're told in James 1, for example, that we can count it all joy when we face trials and unwanted circumstances. Why? Because our joy, our happiness is not rooted in our circumstances. It's rooted in our connection and relationship to God. Jesus didn't have any of the things that we attach to our happiness. He never got married. He never owned a home. He was abandoned by his friends. He was misunderstood and maligned. He faced public and legal scrutiny his whole life, and yet he was filled with joy. Why? Because for his whole life, he demonstrated to us what a right relationship with God looks like. That the happiness you see that you're looking for is found in being rightly related to God, secure in Jesus, walking in his Spirit. People contemplate divorce because they're not happy. They seek addictions or temporary pleasures to make them happy. They try to fill a spiritual void with material things in the name of happiness. But here's the truth, guys. You have a God-shaped void in your soul. And for some of you, you've tried everything you can to fill it. You've tried the party scene. You've tried material stuff. You've tried the outfits. You've tried the car. You tried a different job. You tried a different relationship. Then another one. Then another one. You moved to a different city. You've tried vacations. You've tried to save enough money to make you happy. You've tried everything you can, and there's still that void. That's because there aren't enough things in this whole wide world to fill that. Only a relationship with the one who holds the keys to an abundant life. So I'm not here to promise you happiness today. That would be aiming too low. I can do one better, though. I can promise you a perfect God who will love you, who will comfort you, who will forgive you, who will strengthen you, who will walk with you through every high and every low. And he is enough. You know, the lie we often believe is that God just wants me to be happy. But God's after more than just your happiness. We said he doesn't want you to be happy with the wrong things. Instead, he offered the abundant life, which only comes as a result of pursuing not happiness, but a relationship with him. Let me offer you a couple practical next steps as I conclude today. Would you do some self-reflection today? Would you try to identify an area of your life where you've become consumed with temporary happiness? Maybe it's at work, maybe it's a relationship, maybe a hobby or an addiction, seeking attention. Maybe you're caught up in your looks or what other people think of you, whatever it is. And then as you think of those things, maybe even write them in a journal, would you pray this confessional prayer over all of them? Would you just pray these words? God, you are enough. Remind yourself. You may not even believe it fully. Would you just pray those words? God, you are enough. Because he is enough. Being in right relationship with him is enough. Because he's able to provide purpose and joy and hope and wisdom in ways that nothing else can. That hole in your heart is for him and him alone. You know, I mentioned earlier that I would love for you to commit to this series. In this new year, would you make your spiritual life and development and connecting with your church family a top priority? Make that another next step as well.